Okay, thanks a lot, Mark. So I think Lars' email said I was going to represent the intertwined program. I should definitely say I'm not doing that. There's a lot of interesting things going on in the intertwined programs. I'm just going to focus on one small aspect of it that mainly is of interest to me and a few others. But okay. All right, so as I've announced here, I'm going to talk about quantum matter without quasi-particles. Here the idea is to focus on a set of phases of matter that have been found, say, in the last 20 years that seem to be very, very different from traditional phases that have been studied in condensed matter physics. So quantum condensed matter physics is really, in some ways, an incredibly successful field. With descriptions of all kinds of phases of matter, starting from first principles. Many predictions also of new phases and new types of structures. But if you really look at it more carefully, you realize that much of the success relies on one very crucial assumption. And that's the assumption of the existence of quasi-particles. So imagine you have some incredibly complicated interacting many-body states. You want to know something about its ground state and its low-lying excitations. And often, initially, if you just look at the problem without further thought, you would say this is impossibly complicated because the Hilbert space itself is so incredibly large. But nevertheless, we are able to get by and make really successful predictions because of the idea of quasi-particles. So let me first try to roughly define what a quasi-particle is and how it's been useful in many different things, and then go on to somewhat more careful definition. So a quasi-particle you can think of as simply some excitation of your many-body system, which you can maybe roughly localize in a given region of space. So it's just a lump. It may not be a single electron. It may be an electron surrounded by other excitations. But that lump is locally almost the exact eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. And it can move around a little bit. And if you have translation invariance, you could imagine you could create that lump somewhere else, or here and over there. So just knowing something about an excitation in one region of space, you can build up many other excitations. So you treat these excitations like particles. You call them quasi-particles. And then, they can have strange quantum numbers sometimes. They can have strange interactions. But in the end, the many-body system with the Hilbert space of size e to the n, where n is, say, the number of sites in your system, can be described by order n degrees of freedom, where you've created some density of quasi-particles, which are maybe well separated, but it's all of order n. So you're describing the incredible complexity of a Hilbert space of size e to the n by taking a much smaller set of degrees of freedom. And that, roughly speaking, what a quasi-particle is. So I just began here by listing all the great successes of systems with quasi-particles. Of course, there's the theory of metals, where the quasi-particles are basically electrons dressed by a cloud of particle pairs. And this has been successful in theory of metals, insulators, semiconductors. Now, these quasi-particles can do interesting things. They can, for example, pair. And that's the basis of the BCS theory of superconductivity. The superconducting state then has quasi-particles of its own, as collective modes, which we can also think of as quasi-particles. And also fermionic excitations, the so-called Bogoliubov particles, which are excitations of the superconducting state. Furthermore, you don't even need translational invariance. There's the very successful theory of disordered metals, where the quasi-particles don't move in straight line, but they tend to diffuse. And because they're diffusing and not moving so fast, they tend to have strong interactions. But there's a well-defined regime where those interactions can be controlled. And still, even though it's not obvious when you look at some of the papers on this subject, you are using the quasi-particle assumption. And it's also been incredibly successful. These quasi-particles, in addition to diffusing, can also localize. And that's the Anderson theory of localization of diffusive metals. And then there's also theory of disordered insulators, where again you have quasi-particles which are hopping from localized sites. Maybe you could even go all the way to many-body localization, where there also seem to be some kind of more complicated quasi-particle basis. So one system often held up as an example of a system that does not have, that is non-Fermi liquid. I haven't used that word yet, but non-Fermi liquid sometimes is taken as synonymous with don't have quasi-particles. And that's metals in one dimension. So take a thin wire, like a carbon nanotube. Well, it is true that the electron, like quasi-particle that's present in Fermi liquid theory, doesn't exist in 1D. But if you think about the Hilbert space, the set of low-lying energy eigenstates of the one-dimensional electron gas, they also have a quasi-particle decomposition. It's just the quasi-particles are collective modes. They are basically sound modes, and they completely exhaust all the low-lying states in the 1D electron gas. And then finally, of course, there's the fractional quantum Hall effect, which, again, the electron also doesn't exist as a quasi-particle, but you can get fractions of an electron, the Laughlin quasi-particle, which can be used to describe all the dynamics at low temperatures. Okay, so that's pretty much all of kinesthetic physics in some ways, and really underlying is this very basic idea. Okay, so why do we want to go beyond this? So in our program, we've been studying various materials, the nictites, the cuprates, and they have very complicated phase diagrams. Every time I show one of those to my particle theory friends, their eyes glaze over. They don't want to see it. So I'm not going to show you any. But let me just draw a sketch. So there's two axes. One is, say, usually temperature. And the other is some parameter. It's usually, say, the density of electrons in some crystal. And as you vary these two, you get a whole variety of phases. And the generic phase diagram that appears in many materials is of roughly of this type. That there's some region down here where you have, let me say, intertwined order of various types. So this could be antiferromagnetism, charge density wave, pneumatic order, and maybe even topological order. So topological order here is something characteristic of the fractional quantum Hall effect. So in this ordered state, they can be there in just a large variety of experiments examining these ordered states, their excitations, their structure, and a great deal of remarkable progress has been made, and there's a huge library of things that have been discovered and characterized. But largely speaking, in this region, again, you do have basically some sort of quasi-particle description as far as we can tell. Okay, then on the this end of the phase diagram, when you're moving away some possibly an insulating state here, there's a regular Fermi liquid. So let me just draw this as a dashed line, because it may not even be a phase transition. So here you have a good metal. Well, as far, although this, that also has been questioned in some cases. Meaning that the electrons, maybe they do interact with the Fermi liquid. So it's a good metal. Maybe they interact with each other quite a bit. But in the end, there is some electronic quasi-particle that at least gives a reasonable starting point for what's going on there. And then in between is a regime which has many different names. Yes.
There might not be a phase transition. What are the dashed lines, and what are they separated?
Okay, so this is where we really have to get into the details of the program. So I don't want to. I would say so, but that's an excellent question. I think there are a whole series of. So there's a broken symmetry. In some cases, a broken symmetry can only be present at zero temperature, not at finite temperature. Then this would just be a crossover. But for some broken symmetries, this would be an actual phase transition, like the NMAD, some Ising order parameters, for example. If this is characterized by topological order, then most likely then it doesn't continue to finite temperature, it has to cross over. But in any case, for all of the cases, there can be a phase transition to zero temperature, which may or may not extend to a transition at finite temperature. Yes?
Maybe this is a semantic question, but you have given many examples of quasi-particles.
Yes.
I believe, like, you know, topological stations like Skirmios also
sure.
quasi-particles. So in more general context, you would call quasi-particle the extension spectrum of system, which I cannot map to by quadratic.
No, okay, I will come up with a definition in just a few minutes. So just hold on for a second. A working definition, anyway, for a physicist. So in this regime, as I was about to say, there's people, you know, I'm going to call it the strange metal, sometimes called the bad metal or non-Fermi liquid, but anyway, so this is a name that seems to have stuck. It's strange, meaning that we don't understand much about it. One characteristic that seems to be fairly common is that the resistivity is proportional to temperature over a wide range, and in some cases, by applying, you can also extend this, see this linear resistivity down to very low temperature. There are various spectroscopic measurements which suggest that the electronic quasi-particles is not well-defined, even down to low temperatures here. So this is a regime that's been around for 20 plus years, and still we don't understand much about it. This is really largely the motivation for starting a more systematic study of quantum matter without quasi-particles. Another thing that happens here often, of course, the reason why we're interested in this, there's often down here a dome of superconductivity. I won't say much about it, but the critical temperature in many cases can be quite high. You know, the first question you always get asked when you talk about this phase diagram, can you compute TC? The answer is no. Okay, then what are you doing? That's the most important question here. So here I just want to say is that if you know, to have any hope of computing TC, you have to understand the strange metal, because the real interesting things about this phase diagram, unlike in the BCS theory, is that the superconductor in something like aluminum, if you just go above TC in aluminum, it looks like a perfectly good metal with temperature-independent resistivity and so on. Whereas here, if you go just above TC, you see something really bizarre. So if there's a phase transition here, if you want to compute the critical temperature, that's usually often the most difficult thing. The first thing to do to understand the critical temperature is understand the disordered state above it. Without that, you have no hope of computing TC. So that's really the reason we really have to understand this much better. Okay, so that's a broad introduction. So now let me turn to your question. What is a quasi-particle? What is a more general definition? So I'm going to take the following definition. So what are quasi-particles? So here's maybe a useful way, a general way to say it. Quasi-particles are additive excitations. That means if I give you a bunch of quasi-particles with energy E alpha, and so you can either occupy them or not. Let's imagine they're fermions for simplicity. So either quasi-particle alpha is occupied or not occupied, then you can create a many quasi-particle excitation, E, which is a functional of n of alpha, which will have some total energy, which is sum of the energies of the quasi-particles. And then they can have various two-body interactions in alpha and beta and so on. So here the point is that the total number of possibilities of the many-body states, the total number here is of order 2 to the n, roughly speaking, where n is the size of your system. Whereas the number of parameters that you're using to characterize these 2 to the n state are polynomial in n. n squared, and so on. And the claim is that by taking a polynomial set of parameters, you can very accurately represent, you want to go as high as you want in this expansion to get more and more accuracy here, you can accurately represent an exponentially large set of excited states. Okay, so that's my fairly general definition that doesn't rely really on much. It not, doesn't use translational invariance or any such thing.
I assume
yes.
Some convergence.
Yes. Right. Okay. Okay, so this is one basic property. And the other property, which is I think is closely related to this, but again, there's no rigor in any of this, is that systems with quasi-particles have what I'll say is slow thermalization. That is, if you create some initial state with a few quasi-particles in it, initially the quasi-particles, since that's their by definition, will just move on their own, but eventually they'll find each other and collide. And if there's enough collisions, the system will become, for all practical purposes, thermal. That is indistinguishable from a thermal ensemble at some temperature that's determined by the initial state. So you can ask, how long does this take? Now, this is usually a difficult question to answer. And the answers are different in these cases. But in the most famous example is, of course, Fermi liquid theory of just metals with essentially free electrons with weak interactions. And here the thermalization time, or tau phi, let me call it, will be of order the Fermi energy over temperature squared as temperature goes to zero. So it blows up at low and low temperature. It takes very longer and longer for the quasi-particles to find each other. And it blows up as 1 over temperature squared. You can get different powers in disordered metals. In particular, you get slightly different, get 3 to the 3/2. And in gap systems, it can go even exponentially fast to infinity. Okay, so right now I haven't told you why this is slow. Slow compared to what? Okay, but we'll get to that.
This kind of definition.
Yes.
You don't need to have a gap system?
No.
Otherwise, the energy has a lot of photons.
All right, so. Right, so, okay, that's exactly what I just said. I haven't explained why this is slow. Slow compared to what? I'll come to that in a minute. In particular, you can ask, okay, let's take the opposite limit. How fast can this rate be? What is the fastest possible rate? Which I suspect you know what the answer is going to be. Okay, but let me keep a little bit of suspense. Okay. All right, so that's systems with quasi-particles. So now let me, for most of this talk, forget about this phase diagram and just ask, what are some simple models that don't have quasi-particle? I've given you almost anything you can think of, and in the end it does have quasi-particle. So what are models that don't? So I'm going to write down a couple and then say a few things about their properties. All right. Okay, so I will now leave without. Well, actually, not entirely. All right, so since you have, one thing you notice here, that there's some phase transition at zero temperature. So you might say, okay, well, let's look at models that have a phase transition. Maybe near the critical point, you're going to see some system without quasi-particles. So let's take this very simplest possible quantum, many-body quantum system you can think of, and that's the Ising model. So the Ising model is a quantum system sitting on some lattice, where each lattice you have a spin, although these days you've got to call it a qubit. So in honor of the information program, there's a lattice of qubits. And on these qubits, you can operate some gates. Now, you can do some. They have spins which interact with each other. Okay, so let's say there's a lattice I. Okay, let me use the quantum information language just for fun. Then you have these Pauli operators that can act on each qubit, and I'll only need the X operator and the Z operator. And my Hamiltonian, whose low energy states I want to understand, is minus J sum on, say, nearest neighbors of the Z operators. And then this is, you want to put in quantum fluctuation. This is just the usual Ising model from 1931. But you add in a term that doesn't commute, that makes it more interesting, which is what's called a transverse field, a field pointing in the x direction. And there's your Hamiltonian. Okay. All right, so just by looking at this, you can say a few things right away. So for example, at g equals 0, we know the ground state. So at g equals 0, the ground state is all spins up or all spins down. So we can, so since the spins are all parallel, we call this a ferromagnet. Then on the other hand, when g goes to infinity, then you can throw this term out, and you only have to diagonalize this, because this, so everything is positive, so it wants, you want eigenstates of x, which are spins pointing in the x direction. So now you have a unique ground state, which is not a ferromagnet, with the eigenstates of the x operator, which are, of course, linear combination individually of up and down. All right. So this state, we're going to call this a paramagnet, but really more precisely a quantum paramagnet. All right. So what we see here is a basic property, that there's a broken symmetry in the ferromagnetic state, which is restored in the paramagnetic state. This is the symmetry of flipping the spins from up to down. And so there must be at least one phase transition, and we know there's just one. And an incredible amount is known about that phase transition. So let me just sketch what the phase diagram looks like in analogy to this for this very simple model. So basically, you get the same structure, although things are a little bit different in one and two dimensions. So let me first plot what happens in one dimension. So just a chain. Then there's a phase transition at zero temperature between these two states. And each of these states have some quasi-particle excitations. So what are the quasi-particles, the low-lying excitation that will dominate the low-temperature physics on this side? Well, an excitation would be a state where you get a domain wall between an up and down. So here you get a state which will be up, 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 and then down. So that's, that little domain wall is going to cost some energy. It can move around, the domain walls can collide, and you get some state which has a quasi-particle description. On this side, you have this particular ground state, and now the excitations are just one spin that's pointing the wrong direction, and this can move around and also forms a quasi-particle. So here and here, you do have quasi-particles. Okay, but inspired by the experiment, you look more carefully at the finite temperature crossover phase diagram, and what you find is two crossovers with no phase transition, where you do have a regime we're going to call quantum critical. And this might, you might hope that this is a regime for which a quasi-particle description is not present, because you know, they're quasi-particles on both sides, but they are such a different character that something strange must happen in between. Well, that hope doesn't turn out to be realized, because 1D is special. This model has some very special structure, which allows you to write this quasi-particle and that quasi-particle as two images of the same quasi-particle, which turns out to be a fermion. So this actually is a theory with free fermions. And in here, you're dominated by just the physics of free fermions at finite temperature. So there are more exotic quasi-particles in this particular case. And you know, so it's still very much in this class of systems. Okay, so we fail there. And this failure extends, you know, to other systems in one dimension. Not all of them, but many critical points that you look in 1D, in the end, are really not what we're looking for. So our CFT tools. Okay, so I'm going to go to D equals 2, where there are now significant differences. So one difference at D equals 2, in relation to your question, is now, again, of course, the paramagnet and the ferromagnet pretty much remain. But now there's an actual phase transition here. So I'm going to erase this. So this is the Onsager phase transition between the ordered state of an ionizing ferromagnet and a disordered state. And here you still have a paramagnet, which looks very much like in 1D. And here you don't have domain walls in 1D. You can have little domains that can move around. And those are the quasi-particles in the ordered state. But what happens in D equals 2 is that this is much, much more interesting, this regime inside. And this is really the first example that I've presented of a system without quasi-particles. So this particular critical point in this case is highly non-trivial. It's what we call the Wilson-Fisher conformal field theory, CFT, in 2 plus 1 dimensions. So I'm going to call it a CFT3. So it was originally discovered by Wilson and Fisher as a their motivation, it seemed to be, was entirely about a classical Ising model in 3 dimensions, you know, which has the famous Curie transition. Now, there's a long history in physics of understanding the Curie transition in 3 dimensions, ultimately understood by Wilson and Fisher in a theory of thermal fluctuations strongly coupled to each other at long length scales. Now, when you reinterpret that theory in the quantum language in 2 plus 1 dimension, that's then describing a phase of matter, at least at this one point and at temperatures above it, which does not have this kind of quasi-particle description. Okay, So what is it described by? Well, today you would say it's a conformal field theory. And you can, you know, work out a few things about it. Certainly critical exponents are known very accurately. But suppose I ask this question here. How long does the system thermalize, take to thermalize? Can you compute it? Unfortunately, that's a question that even today we can't answer with any accuracy. We can make some progress, and of course I've written a whole book talking about this kind of effort, starting from some limit where there are quasi-particles, some large N limit or what's called the epsilon expansion. And you expand away from it, and you try to compute the dynamical properties in this regime. So I'll say no quasi-particle. And what you learn from that kind of analysis is that, at least roughly, but we can't get the numbers right, that this time, tau phi, the thermalization time, turns out to be some number, which is a pure number, which is in fact a universal number characteristic of this conformal field theory, times h bar over kVT. Okay. So as temperature goes to zero, this time is much shorter than this time. So that's what I meant that this is shorter. You keep everything fixed and send temperature to zero and see which time is shorter. So in that limit, this is shorter than this. And in fact, I erased the list. If you go back and look at the list of examples, it's shorter than every of those examples. There's no system with quasi-particles known which reliably you get a time of this order. So this naturally leads the conjecture, which is what I proposed in 1999, that there is a shortest possible time of this order, h bar over kVT. No system will thermalize or dephase faster than this. Yes?
And that any system with quasi-particles will thermalize parametrically slower.
Yes, yes.
So that's a sort of, even if we didn't know what quasi-particles were, we could tell.
Yes, exactly. Thank you. You just said what I wanted to say.
Sorry.
Thank you. No, great. Of course, there's an open question, which would be nice to have a proof someday, that this definition and the definition just proposed are equivalent. I don't, there's no proof of that. But what is certainly true, for example, you could imagine, you know, if you're just doing dimensional analysis, you could imagine that there's some system in which, say, tau phi is, for example, h bar over, say, square root of j times temperature. I mean, j is an energy scale. There's no such system known. So this would be time even shorter than h bar over kt. So this is not possible, at least as far as we know. If you find such a system, well, then you've discovered something new about rapid thermalization. Okay, all right. So this really, you know, this studying conformal field theories in higher dimensions has been a very fruitful way to learn more about systems without quasi-particles. But those are, you know, still extremely difficult to work with. Because you're in higher dimensions. So you can put supersymmetry, but even with supersymmetry, dynamical properties are very difficult to compute, or transport properties, for example, especially in this finite temperature regime. Of course, if you put enough supersymmetry, then you have all these new dualities to the gravity theories, which I'm going to come to from a different route. All right, so any questions so far? All right, so now let me talk about another class of models, and the second system without quasi-particle, and that's going to be what people are now calling the SYK model. And this was proposed in a form different from the one I'm going to present by myself and my first student, Jinwoo Ye, in 93. Everything I'm going to say today also applies to our original model, but Kitaev a couple of years ago proposed a simplification that, from my point of view, has the main benefit that it certainly allows us to do numerics in a much faster way, and so test many of the things that we had guessed at in the early days. And there was also a lot of work by George and Parcollet and collaborations between me and them, which obtained some of the results I'm going to mention. Actually, so I prepared slides for this talk, although I'm not showing them, and I refer you to the slides for all the references, so I may not refer to everybody here, and I'll post those online. All right, so let me first begin with an almost trivial model, just to illustrate, you know, what this type class of models does. So this is a class of models, first of all, with randomness. So that immediately scares people away. But it's okay. The randomness is actually pretty innocuous in the sense that these systems, at least the one I'll talk about in the regime that I'm interested in them for this talk, are self-averaging. That is, if you have a sufficiently large system, and you don't look too closely, every site looks like every other site. So randomness, in some ways, is really a... But first of all, it's present in experiments, so that was our original motivation. But it also turns out, and as we recognized even in the early days, it allows you to actually solve a whole class of models with randomness that would be very hard to solve without randomness. It just really is very useful. Sometimes it can, you know, betray you and give you horrible things like spin glasses, but those are also fun to study. Okay, so let's just start with free fermions moving on a completely random matrix. So here, so you have some on I and J, Pij, spinless fermions, F dagger I, Fj. So these are anti-commuting operators. You've got the Ij, and similarly for Fi, Fj, let me just put it in completeness, is zero. Okay, so, you know, and the other statement of these Tij, I'm going to put a factor of 1 over square root of n here, and these go from 1 to n. So the Tij, the most important property of them are independent random numbers. And also, I'm going to take them to have zero mean. Okay, so just take n sites. You know, in this case, since it's just a free-form Hamiltonian, you could easily take n of a few hundred thousand or even a million. So you have million squared random numbers, and then just diagonalize this Hamiltonian and look at its property. So let me. Yes, yes, thank you. Okay. Now, this is a one-particle system, and so the way you would do this, it would be very silly to do it any other way, is to simply just find the eigenvectors and eigenvalues of the matrix Dij, and then build up the many-particle state from the one-particle state. So if I do that, so there will be some Tij has eigenvalues, and these are just the quasi-particle eigenvalue. These are the quasi-particle energies in this case, and the total energy of the system is sum 1 alpha n alpha e alpha. And in this simple model, there are no higher-order terms, so it trivially has quasi-particles. And the e alpha, I can define some density of states, rho of omega, which is sum on alpha delta of omega minus e alpha. And if we just average over a little bit as a function of omega, this has the famous Wigner semicircular density of state from some number of order t to t, where here t is tij mod squared, average is t squared. Okay, various factors of 2, square root of 3 are forgotten. Okay, so there's a bandwidth of order 1 where you're going to occupy states, and these are the single particle eigenvalues. So for the many particle system to build up this set of states, the ground state you'll obtain by picking some Fermi energy here, and then you occupy all states below the Fermi energy. Okay, now you can try to do, there's a plot I have which I'll try to draw on the board. Just make a plot of all the possible values of E. So E has 2 to the n values. So you make a plot of these values, and you get some set of values here. Okay, this is a very terrible plot, but there's 2 to the n numbers that you're going to create by just using this formula. Just take one instance of Tij. All right, so basic things you can say is that the bandwidth is of order nt. That's how, you know, it's extensive. That's how many, how much the energy will vary between the smallest and the largest energies. And the total number of states is 2 to the n. So if you look at the middle of the band, if you look at the energy level spacing, delta E, it's got to be 2 to the minus n. I'm again ignoring all free factors of powers of n, because the exponential is so strong. However, there's something very special about the bottom of the band. So the ground state is right here, where all of these states are occupied. So imagine there's some discrete set of energy levels. The spacing between these levels is 1 over n. So this window is 1 over n. I should say that, you know, why is the spacing so large? Well, the reason it's so small, sorry. Why is it so small? The reason it's so small is as you go from one level to the next, these n alpha change completely. All of them take very different values in a chaotic manner from one to the next. And that's why they're able to get so close to each other. On the other hand, when you're just near the ground state, this is the ground state where everything is occupied, and you want to create an excited state. The only way you can create an excited state is take an electron from here and move it there. And that's going to have a width of order 1 over n. So a generic property of this system, if you look at the energy level spacing near the bottom of the band, it's much, much larger than the energy level spacing in the middle of the band. And that really, you can see the reason that's happening is because of the existence of this type of formula. And so this large energy level spacing in this model is a signature for the presence of quasiparticles. Now, one thing you can do is you can add interactions. I haven't done it, but we've done various calculations with weak interactions, say, in this model. And these features still remain. You get more complicated quasiparticles. There's going to be additional terms in this expansion. But as long as there's such an expansion which is well behaved, you're going to get much larger spacing at the bottom of the band than in the center. All right. Okay, so now I'm ready to introduce the SYK model, which is very much the same thing, except you don't have a two Fermi term, it has a four Fermi term. So it's JIJK. And there it is. So that's the full. You know, I could give these two lines to a mathematician, and in fact I have. tell him to solve it. I mean, it completely defines the problem. And this problem, as we'll see, has connections to quantum gravity of all things and black holes. Okay, but there it is. You don't need to learn supersymmetry or string theory. Just that's it, two lines. And a lot of interesting properties appear. So now, these are all random numbers. There's n to the fourth random numbers with zero mean. And g squared. Okay. No, thank you. Okay. So now, this model, you know, first of all, you might think we just saw a random matrix model. So you might say this is a random matrix. Well, it is, but it's not any old random matrix, because the size of the matrix, since it's a many-body problem, is 2 to the n by 2 to the n. But the number of random numbers is n to the fourth. So it's a mostly empty random matrix with very strong correlation. So it's a highly sparse matrix. Some properties are like that of random matrices, but as long as you're looking at energy scales of order 1, they're very different from a random matrix. Okay, so what happens here? Well, I'm wondering on time. 15 minutes more? Okay, so I won't go through how this is all solved. So the things like the energy and the entropy and so on were worked out by paper by Antoine George Parkley and myself in 99. And now, of course, we have much more improved derivations of a lot of those, which luckily agreed with, where they overlap with their previous results. Okay, so I can't say this anymore. So again, the bandwidth is about a JN. This is still true. And this is 2 to the minus N, which I will write as e to the minus N log 2. And what happens is that this model, even at the bottom of the band, the energy level spacing is e to the minus n times S0, where S0 is a number that we obtained and I'm very proud of it, so I'm going to actually give you the value. So I have one precise result in this talk. So it turns out to be g over pi plus log 2 over 4, where g is Catalan's number. Okay, you have to look up what that is. 0.464848. whatever it is, it's less than log 2. Okay, so this was obtained through a rather many pages of algebra and diagrammatics by Olivier Parkley mainly. Using the Luttinger-Ward functional, if I'm sure none of the non-condensed matter physicists know what that is. More recently, Kitay have obtained it by a different route. Fortunately, got exactly the same answer. Okay, but both methods, Kitay's method and our method, are highly non-rigorous. I mean, they involve certain assumptions of convergence of integrals, which you just go ahead and, but physicists tend to not worry too much about. So it's not a mathematical proof by any sense. It's been numerically checked today, and it works. It's okay. But I think it would be great if the more mathematically inclined physicists, who, you know, basically just starting from this, this is the definition of the entire problem, and come up with a rigorous measurement of this number, for example. So there's a challenge. Okay, so of course here the point is that this spacing is still much larger than this spacing as n becomes large, but it's much smaller than 1 over n, or any power of n. It's still exponentially small, but it's just, so there is a sparseness of the states, but it's there's still many, many states down at the bottom of the spectrum. There's no degeneracy except some trivial ones having to do with particle hole symmetry or something like that. And what these states are is something that's really not well understood. It's some characterizing feature of a system that really does not want a quasi-particle description. Okay. All right, so many things about this model. Yes?
Can you get a similar exponential dependence if you have rare localized states and just like a Griffith state disorder potential? For the global?
I don't think so, no. You'd have the on-site energies will vary by order 1 over n. There may be exponentially small interactions, but the on-site energies should be different.
I just mean if you have a region of length L, the
okay. All right, this is not a Griffith's effect, for sure. I mean, if here you have infinite range interactions, it's a bulk property, really.
There are some small energy spaces, but I don't think the density is
small. Yes, there's no, this violates the third law of thermodynamics, okay. In fact, that's why we put this result in an appendix, because we said this has got to be wrong, but, okay. Yes.
This is a question slash comment. You know, the other example that you gave, the Ising model,
That
would have polynomial small gaps.
So that doesn't have this property.
It's not one-to-one between systems.
There's many other ways to describe quasi-particle. I suspect this is kind of generic in models that have no space. This is a zero-dimensional model. Then you've got to have this many levels near the ground state. The Ising model is a spatial structure, so that certainly obeys the third law of thermodynamics. Meaning, what do I mean by the third law of thermodynamics? That the entropy, as T goes to zero, so one consequence of this is that the entropy is n times S0, so it's extensive in the number of spins. And then, so this was known a long time ago, but now through the work of Maldacena and Stanford, we know the first correction, and it's linear in T, and this gamma is some number that depends on on J. Okay. All right, so that's a basic property. Then what's also been done is you can plot the many density of states of density of many particle states. So this is not rho of E alpha that I had before, but of this capital E, which is the many, many particle energy. It turns out to be as near the ground state as this exponentially large factor, just coming from the spacing. And what was worked out by Witten and Stanford from something I don't think I have time to really go into how they got this, something like 2 and the same gamma here times the excitation energy. So what this does look like is the following. So suppose I take a Fresnel quantum Hall state with non-abelian quasi-particles. And you take n quasi-particles, then we know there's a degeneracy of 2 to the n over 2, which is lifted by things moving around. So there, of course, there's a quasi-particle interpretation along with topological order, but n is the number of quasi-particles. It's not the number of degrees of freedom. So this is much larger entropy, but you know, roughly speaking, it looks like, if I just stare at this formula, that there's some underlying energy states that have width about a 1 over n, because this is just proportional to n here. So this And each one of those states is degenerate, has this degeneracy, but not quite. They're spread out and they overlap, so you can't really separate them. So we don't really have a clean understanding of what this formula means, but it turns out to be something that is a property of this model and also a property of gravity, which is, I just have, here's the clock, so I have 10 minutes to explain the connection to gravity, and that's probably as far as I'm going to get. So some other properties I should mention in addition to this. You can also compute correlation functions, which is in fact what we did in the early days. You can find that the Green's function of a fermion on a given site at t equals 0 goes as 1 over square root of time. So there's a power law. It's a gapless system, as you might expect. And also, you can show that at finite temperature, this is at t equals 0, and at t greater than 0, this is shown by George and Parcolet, it turns out to be 1 over sinh pi t tau to the 1/2. So this was a kind of a shocking result at that time. In my first paper, we did try to do the finite temperature variation and succeed, and then a few years later, Parcolet and George succeeded. And there's a very strong indication that there's some conformal invariance, because the sinh for the expert is exactly the kind of thing you get from conformal mappings. I mean, here's the model. There's no obvious conformal invariance, but it does seem to be present in looking at the finite temperature correlation function. Okay, so now all I want to say is that all of these properties are also properties of a semi-classical theory of gravity. And I'll just tell you what that is. And that's probably as much time as I have. So the simplest theory you want to take is basically the theory of a universe, Einstein and Maxwell, and all you do is you change the value of the cosmological constant. So your action is, okay, here I'm going to betray my ignorance, so d4x in space-time, you have 1 over e squared f squared, that's Maxwell, plus Einstein, and then you add a cosmological constant, lambda. Let me see. I make sure I get the signs right here. Let me make that. Yeah. Okay. So this is our theory of our universe. It's very simple. It just has infinite flat universe when provided lambda is close to zero, with photons and gravitons. However, what you want to do is you want to take your cosmological constant is much, much less than zero. So order 10 to the 40 different from our universe or something like that. So the natural scale would make it negative. And then you also want to take a certain set of boundary conditions which give you what's called the ADS Reisner-Nordström solution. So what does that look like? So this is three space and one time. So two of the space are going to be flat. So this is going to be our ordinary space, x. So x1, x2, two dimensions here. And we're going to take a solution which is curved in the other direction, which we're going to call R, I suppose. So this is the way it's typically drawn. So this is called this R. And then we're going to take boundary conditions. We're going to smear some charge on our boundary here. So there's going to be some charge Q, which creates an electric field. Okay, so those are the boundary conditions you choose. And when you do that, you get a black hole horizon at some finite distance away from the boundary. And you can study properties of that black hole. Now, of course, this is very much along the lines of the ADS-CFT correspondence that came out of string theory. And what the ADS-CFT correspondence has told us They're often quantum systems, which you put on the boundary here, which have, in my language, they're always systems without quasi-particles, strongly entangled. And those strongly entangled systems are dual to theory of gravity. And for the case of super-Yang mills with maximal supersymmetry and many other related models, that kind of duality is pretty well established today. So here, and this is what I did in a paper in 2011, just use that formula and try to see, is there some black hole solution? When you look at its properties down here, they match all the properties I've mentioned over there. And it turns out the answer, of course, is yes, otherwise I wouldn't be writing it down. So in this case, when you put a finite charge density here, what happens as you, also one more thing, to match the SYK model, I've got to make this dimension finite. So imagine this is a torus of some finite size, some size L. Okay, so it's in the spatial direction. So on out here is sitting SYK.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
So the SYK model has neither extended supersymmetry nor fine-tuning.
Yes.
How would it correspond to something with weak curvature?
Okay. I'm just going to map properties, yes. Well, I mean, so you do have to do quantum gravity fluctuations to get some of those corrections over there. It's 2D gravity, so I guess you can make some progress in looking at its fluctuations. Okay, but we don't, I agree. This is just, at this point, it's just matching, inspired by the ADS-CFT equation, matching properties of the black hole solution to all those properties I mentioned there.
I mean, it would be fantastic if it were, because it would be a new solution of the cosmological constant problem.
Oh, okay. All right, great. More power to you. All right.
Thank you for claiming that.
Okay, no, I'm certainly not.
You fine-tune the quadratic term to zero.
Yes, right? Yes, correct. And in this language, that corresponds to, you would have some cutoff to space-time here, right? But nothing else. You can add any number of additional 6-fermion, 8-fermion. So it's a fairly robust thing. It's not fine-tuned other than one relevant operator. Well, actually, Cenk says there's one more, but OK. all right, so what happens as you approach the black hole horizon, the geometry here becomes what's called ADS2 cross. In this case, this is a torus, so I'm going to call it T2. So the T2 part doesn't matter. We're looking at scales where essentially this T2 is just a point. We're going to look at very low energies. So this becomes like a 0+1 dimensional theory, quantum mechanically. There's just a point in space and there's time, which is exactly the structure of the SYK model. Whereas here, of course, now this part, it's not 0+1, it's 1+1. And that's holography. You're going to equate a system in 0+1 dimension to a system in 1+1 dimension, which is ADS2. So ADS2 is simple enough that I can even write down its metric. So you have to do some rescaling with R. You take a new coordinate I call zeta, which goes to infinity at the horizon at zero temperature. And this metric is simply time less zeta squared over zeta squared. So this is antithesis of phase in 1+1 dimension. So what was worked out originally by Hong Liu and John McGreevy was various properties of quantum fields moving this curved spacetime. And also, you can just from the Hawking formula compute the entropy and specific heat and correlation functions of fermions in particular moving in this spacetime. And what I noted in 2011 is that all of those properties, well, of course, not this factor because that's more recent, not known at that time, completely match what you see here. There's a finite ground state entropy, which is extensive. You can take the mass of the fermion to fix this, and this also works. Okay, so what's been done in the last couple of years is that much more meat has been put to this proposal. What people have looked at is a very systematic treatment of fluctuations, Gaussian fluctuations of the Gravitron mode in ADS2. You also have to put in a scalar. In this language, that scalar corresponds to fluctuation the size of the torus. So you do essentially a treatment of quantum gravity corrections about ADS2. And what you get from that after an amazing calculation, which I can only dimly understand, you get this result here. And that calculation involves what's called the Schwarzschian, which is some effective theory of quantum gravity fluctuations about this geometry. And what Maldacena and Stanford showed was you could derive the Schwarzschian in two different ways. You could start with the SYK model and do just, you know, the usual 1 over n type fluctuations that many of us meet often in condensed matter physics. Here, the technical difficulties are much harder because you've got a gapless state you're fluctuating about. Or you can start with this theory and do systematic Gaussian corrections about this saddle point solution. From both methods, you get the Schwarzschian, which gives you this factor. And this factor also agrees in numerical studies on the SYK model. That's in the paper by Stanford and Witten. Okay, so I think there's a great deal of evidence that this SYK model is connected to black holes, at least some of its low energy properties. But people like David are working on looking at higher order correlation function, and Vlad, and really trying to sharpen this connection. It's clearly not some string theory that we already know. It's something more complicated. But at least for these properties, things seem to match. I think that's really all I want to say.
Model, you say that the ground state entropy is not zero.
I'm very careful to call it a zero temperature entropy.
Yeah, that's what I said. The energy levels are
not degenerate.
Not degenerate.
Yes.
But this is some limit of the entropy as t goes to zero.
Right. You take the n goes to infinity limit first, and then the t goes to zero limit. There is no. Okay, I will admit, and then when we wrote our 99 paper, we weren't particularly clear on this point. That's partly why we stopped working on this model. We thought, oh, this has got some ground state degeneracy. This is horrible. Okay, anyway. But luckily, we wrote it all off. But it's not a ground state entropy. It's really a zero temperature entropy. You have to go to finite temperature first and then take the zero temperature limit. So it's very different from something like the ice model. So the Pauling has an ice model, right, which has a ground state entropy because of all these degenerate configuration. That is a ground state entropy. It violates the third law of thermodynamics. And it's amazingly non-robust. No matter what you do, it'll disappear. You put in even any perturbation you want, you will get zero entropy in the ground state in the thermodynamic limit. This is not like that at all. This is much more robust. You can do lots of things, it doesn't change. And it's not a ground state entropy, it's a zero temperature entropy. Yeah.
If you take most Hamiltonians that have a quasi-particle description, and then if you take some Hamiltonian that has a quasi-particle,
yeah,
and then square it,
yeah,
the resulting Hamiltonian should have this property.
I don't think so, but question was, if you take some Hamiltonian that has quasi-particle and square it, will you get a Hamiltonian that doesn't have quasi-particles?
How can that be? I mean, all right.
Well, because if you put the middle, if you put the energy so that the middle of the band gets pushed down to the lowest energy.
Well, okay, certainly when we started first looking at this, our motivation maybe was in that spirit, that we were thinking, we were not really trying to understand systems this random. In fact, there was a lot of work with DMFT that I've been talking to Antoine George a lot in those days. And what we had noted was that many of the DMFT equations, which were derived for a non-random model, could also be applied to a random model. And in fact, derived from the random model much more easily. So that's kind of why I started looking at this model, just not because I wanted to understand the random system, but because it seemed like a route to a randomness really helped you and get something strongly interacting and solvable at the same time, which is not so easy to do. Of course, now we know non-random models, the so-called color tensor models, which do the same thing, which have the same saddle point, which don't have any randomness. Their 1 over n fluctuations are different and more complicated in many ways.
So you gave us sort of two different ways of looking at the quasi-particles or lack of quasi-particles. One
yes.
was with this packaging, one was with this time scale.
Yes.
Is there a way to sort of phrase the absence of quasi-particles in terms of some entanglement structure? You sort of said, made some connection that if it's strongly entangled, then...
I'm not sure. So for example, if I take a topological state in 2 plus 1 dimension that has this topological entanglement entropy, which is a constant in addition to the area law. On the other hand, a conformal field theory also has a constant. But of course, that constant depends on geometry. So just looking at that constant, you can't tell. In one case, it does work, in the other, it doesn't. So the entanglement entropy seems like a rather crude diagnostic of that, I suspect. There may be others, but... But yes, of course, the idea is, you know, this SYK Hamiltonian is a Hamiltonian with no kinetic energy, just entanglement. You know, that's what it is. Every time the only way an electron can move is by entangling with another electron. They have to move in pairs. So, okay, that's my 2 cents worth. Yeah.
You were trying to interpret that result in terms of things which are separated 1 over n, you have at each of these, you have...
Crude idea, yes.
If I just do exact diagonalization, do you see something like that?
No, you don't. You just see a whole bunch of levels with no structure.
Okay.
Yeah, right.
So, could you comment on the status of this closed bound and fastest thermalization? So that's based on many solvable models on this... Found on chaos.
I ran out of time. I had a whole bunch of things to say about that, but since they gave me the opportunity, so the thermalization time, there's nothing rigorous. I mean, as far as I know, there is no known counterexample. You know, there's nothing that thermalization time is 1/√ temperature as T goes to zero. But of course, one very beautiful development was originally started by Steve Schenker and Douglas Stanford, starting from the black holes, where they were asking questions about black holes and their dynamics. And they found that in black holes, there's something that they identified as the Lyapunov time, which is the time to quantum chaos, which seemed to be exactly equal in many, many theories of gravity to 1/2 pi t. That was the time. And then later with Maldacena, they proved, quote-unquote proved, there are some assumptions, reasonable assumptions there, that is a lower bound. And then Kitaev showed that the SYK model saturates that lower bound. So that, I think, it was that particular thing that finally got string theorists interested in the SYK model. I gave a talk at Strings in 2011 on all of this, much of what I said here, so maybe not as clearly. No reaction. But I think once that bound, you know, people, I think gravitational physics, for reasons I don't understand completely well, but maybe others can comment. This Lyapunov time and this chaos is really fundamental to the black hole information problem. And so at that point, this is a very strong indication. So we have also looked at this Lyapunov time, and others have. Avishkar Patel has written a nice paper on this, computing this Lyapunov time in some strongly interacting electronic systems like Fermi surface coupled to gauge field. And then you get a time of order 1 over temperature, which in the approximation that we can solve, it does obey the bound. But, okay.
I'm not saturated.
No, it does not saturate. But it's of order 1 over temperature. So again, I would say there that if the Lyapunov time is some other power of temperature, and it has to be greater than 1, 1 over some power of temperature greater than 1, then it's probably a system that has quasi-particles.
How, if at all, do you feel that SYK and other spaceless models shed light on the sort of the phase diagram you started with? Or
okay, another great question. I have slides on that, too. Well, so I just mentioned here there's a very nice work by Song, Jian, and Balance, who take a couple lattice of SYK models, where you have both this Jij term, which they call it Uij because it's really an on-site term, and hopping, all random. And there's a low coherence scale, which is about a t squared over u. And between an energy scale t squared over u and u, they get a linear resistivity and a Fermi liquid, correlated Fermi liquid at lower temperatures. And I think Avishkar and others have been recently looking at the tensor model without randomness, and they have the same basic property. So anyway, so this is all very much work in progress, I guess.
Any more questions? Okay, thanks very much.